Good morning, everyone. First case is the matter of Elmer Branch versus Cream Olan Dairy. May we please have appearances of counsel?
David Kott, K-O-T-T, McCarter in English, for the petitioner defendant, Cream Olan.
Ravi Sadaraju of Sadaraju & Tharney on behalf of plaintiff respondent, Elmer Branch.
Jacobson.
Jeffrey Jacobson, Fagery Drinker, Biddle and Reith, on behalf of AMICI, the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute, and the National Federation of Independent Business.
Good morning. Thomas Lindhorst of Morgan Lewis, on behalf of AMICI, New Jersey Business and Industry Association, and the Commerce and Industry Association of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Caroline Jones, on behalf of AMICUS, State of New Jersey.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michael Galpern from the law firm of Javabon Wargaft on behalf of AMICUS New Jersey Association for Justice. Thank you.
Good morning to all counsel and welcome. Mr. Kott, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
I want to start with what the uncontroverted facts were before the trial court. Three different employees on three different occasions over a 10-year period made a complaint that they were not being paid proper overtime. All three complaints were fully investigated, and there were three decisions. All three decisions were made by employees of the department who were fully authorized by the commissioner to make the decisions. So there were three decisions, all in writing, and they all found the same two things. First, that Cream Olan was a trucking industry employer, and second, that it was paying the proper overtime wage. The statute we're talking about is reproduced at pages 6 and 7 of our petition. That's 6 and 7. And I want to start with what the statute does not say. The statute does not say, to have the benefit of the good faith defense, that there must be a final decision of the commissioner after a full adversarial OAL proceeding. It does not say that the decision needs to have the imprimatur of the commissioner. And it does not say that the decision has to be a broad policy that applies to all employers in the state. Let me now turn to what the statute does say, and it creates two categories for how you have the good faith defense, and I'm going to deal with the second one. The second category says, or any administrative practice or enforcement policy of such department or bureau with respect to the class of employees to which he belonged. Any does not mean final decision after an OAL hearing. Any does not mean imprimatur. Any does not mean a policy that applies to all employers. Administrative practice, that just means a course of dealing by the department. Here, there were three different complaints resolved by the department over a 10-year period. Enforcement policy. Here, there were three complaints over a 10-year period that ended up with the department not taking any enforcement action. Statute says of such department or bureau, doesn't say commissioner or director. In the first category, it says that, but I'm going to get to that. But here it just says department or bureau. And then it says with respect to the class of employers to which he belonged. The three decisions were as to a class of employers. The class was a transportation company. So we meet the elements of the second category. Turning to the first category, it says any, and then it's got some things, ruling, approval, or interpretation. Approval just means permission. We got permission three times. Interpretation, we know what that means. The three rulings interpreted both the trucking industry employer exemption and the proper overtime wage. And ruling, Here we had three complaints, fully investigated, and all three times there was a ruling that Cremaland was not violating the law. I would note in the first category, unlike the second, there's not a reference to the class of employers to which he belonged. That only appears in the second. I recognize that the first category uses the words commissioner or director, but at the time the statute was enacted, and I would guess from the beginning of time, commissioners and directors acted through their authorized agents. The legislature would know there is no way that a commissioner or director could deal with every issue that came before the department. Let me just turn for a moment to whether the statute should be interpreted broadly. We recognize that this is a remedial statute. However, the provision we're talking about was enacted to protect employers from the large penalties that could be assessed against them if they violated this law. And we see how broadly that protection is, because the statute at the end of the section says the employer has the benefit of a good faith defense even if the determinations were legally incorrect. And it's interesting the legislature in this provision used the word defense. In other provisions, they use the word exemption. Here they use the word defense, and those are two very different things. An exemption applies to all employers and all employees across the state. A defense is limited simply to a single employer. Finally, as to the deference that should be given to the opinion of the Attorney General, we believe it should not be given deference for three reasons. First, it is an opinion limited solely to a legal issue. What do the words of this statute mean? Second, it is plainly unreasonable. The Attorney General has rewritten this statute for all the reasons I said before. And third, it was first expressed as an amicus in this litigation, a complete and total unfair surprise to Cremaland that had relied upon the three decisions. So for these reasons, we request that the judgment of the appellate division be reversed and that the judgment of the law division be reinstated. Thank you.
Mr. Cott, can you go back to the statute? And I thank you for helping parse it for us. The first category, as you noted, specifies two actors, the commissioner and the director. And the second category doesn't contain that specificity. Can the court look to the federal standard, the reasonably prudent person standard, to help better understand and give meaning to this statute?
Well, I think it can, Your Honor. In fact, this is kind of an interesting record. In the appellate division, the plaintiffs argued that the court should look to the federal case. In this court, the plaintiff may take a different position. And I will confess, Your Honor, that when we look at all the federal cases, about 90% of them support our position, but they're not uniform. There are some cases that do not. There are some cases that say, for instance, a letter is not good enough. But the overwhelming number of federal cases say on this record, the three determinations in writing by the people who made them would be enough under the good faith defense under the federal statute.
If we do look to federal law for cases, what is your position with respect to the court looking at the regulations that have been adopted by the Department of Labor for the federal statute? Because there are definitions in 29 CFR 790.18 and .17 that define the two categories of terms that you are parsing for us in our statute, and the language matches up fairly closely. Obviously, the federal statute has some specific language that refers to the Department, U.S. Department of Labor, unlike ours.
Yeah, Justice LaVecchia, those regulations have not been enacted by the Department of Labor. So I'm not sure they're meaningful here. The Department of Labor, those regulations have been on the federal books forever. So the Department of Labor in New Jersey could have adopted them, but chose not to. So I don't know that they're that helpful, although I...
In terms of the federal department, you know, beginning to look at this question, you don't think it's illuminating?
Well, when I look at the federal cases, there is some reference to the regulations, but most of the federal cases deal with this wording of the statute, as I've done here, Justice LaVecchia.
Mm-hmm. May I ask a separate question? I apologize, Justice Patterson, for abusing my time. The statute that we're focused on in New Jersey law, defense to action, that has the good faith defense in it, is in a particular article of Title 34, Article 2. Correct?
Yes, that's
and then
correct.
Article 3 says, as used in this article, commissioner means Department of Labor or his designee. There's a specific reference there that acknowledges the commissioner being able to be equated with a designee. Under Article 2, the definition of commissioner does not have that same language. How important do you think that difference is in terms of interpreting this good faith defense statute that is in Article 2?
Yeah, I see the reason for the question, but I don't think it's that important because we're still coming back to the legislative intent. And again, the legislature could never have intended that the commissioner or director would deal with these three types of problems. In fact, Justice LaVecchia, on this record, I think a literal interpretation of commissioner or director is absurd for this reason. We prevailed on the three occasions. There was no way to take an appeal and go up through the Office of Administrative Law and get to the commission.
That was the question I was about to ask, Mr. Cott. It seemed to me that if you had lost any of those applications, you could have and had an administrative penalty assessed against your client. You could then request a hearing, seek an ALJ's determination, and then ultimately a decision by the commissioner. So if essentially through those channels you lost in the first instance any of those determinations, you could get a decision of the commissioner potentially reversing that, and your client would be home free. I assume yes. You agree with that being it. But what I could not see in the statute is how someone who won in the first instance and arguably might have a stronger case than the person who lost before a hearing officer or someone, an employee of the department. There's no way to appeal a win. And so you can't get – and tell me if I'm wrong about this. It doesn't seem to me to be a procedural mechanism for your client to ever get a decision by the commissioner or the director as defined in the appellate division's decision.
I think that's right, and I think that forms one of the bases for my legislative intent. The other thing is if we got a favorable decision from the commissioner, we would not need – the good faith defense. We would have won with the commissioner. So that's yet another reason why a literal application in this instance of commissioner or director, I think, would be contrary to legislative intent.
Justice Alvin, you're muted.
Thank you. Mr. Cott, could you have sought an advisory opinion from the director or the commissioner on the very issue that is now before us?
The answer is yes, legally, and I'm not sure practically. And what I mean by that, Justice Alvin, is, and I'm going to take the current times with a pandemic, two parts to the pandemic, health, which is the Department of Health, and unemployment, which is the Department of Labor, which is besieged with unemployment claims. So in this time, had an employer sought an opinion, I'm not sure that the department have an obligation to give one, and I'm not sure we would get one.
But this case goes back before the pandemic. We're not talking. This case is going back to 2019. The reason why I asked that question is because the Attorney General's position, and I want you to respond to this, is that the documents to which you've referred were all generated during the investigative and informant settlement stages of the division's enforcement proceedings, and that they were generated by subordinate employees and not, and as we know, not subject to administrative appeal. And that's one of the reasons why the Attorney General's office is saying there was no high-level determination. And that's the reason why the Attorney General is saying that you're not entitled to the good faith defense. So why don't you respond to that?
Sure. When we say high level, I'm not sure what that means. The third one, which
well, start with the beginning. They're saying that this was, these documents are just investigative informant settlement stages. That's what they're saying. And they're saying that this cannot possibly constitute like an administrative practice to which the Department of Labor should be held. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't see, because we start with the three proceedings where we have three senior employees, or two senior employees, who under the statute have broad powers to obtain information. In fact, if an employer does not cooperate, that's a misdemeanor. They're backed up by the best and largest law firm in the state, and by that I'm referring to the Attorney General. That's their law firm. And they end up looking at all of the facts three times and doing a complete investigation and coming to a conclusion that Cremoland did not violate the law. And Justice Alvin, on should we have sought a formal opinion, one of the precepts that this court has said in statutory interpretation is we won't have an interpretation that a ordinary citizen or business would think the statute, we wouldn't have one that is contrary to the interpretation of an ordinary business or citizen. No ordinary business, big or small, whether it's Cremoland, a small company, or whether it's Johnson & Johnson, a gigantic company, would think, well, I've got the three decisions. Oh, now to protect myself, I got to do something else. I got to go and get a formal opinion. And I don't think the legislature intended that either, Justice Alvin.
Well, I guess one of the issues, and I want your, is whether or not, like, all Cremoland employees should be bound by one of these, like, low-level investigative determinations. And I'm looking at 43A, which is an email. It looks like an email that begins, "Hi, Mark." And that's the way it begins. It's the height of informality. "Hi, Mark." And then it's Schrager, the section chief, giving his decision on a case apparently that was like non-contested and it was like over.
Well,
so
no.
The question is like how much weight should be given to that, and should all Cremoland employees be bound by such informal decisions such as that? Go ahead.
Justice Alvin, first of all, the three employees have a right under the statute to go before a wage referee. So the three employees at issue could have done that. They had that right under the statute. I reject that this was not an adversarial proceeding. This, again, I'll incorporate by reference. They have broad investigatory powers. Indeed, their powers are greater under the statute than a litigant would have under our discovery rules. Their decisions of the 2017 is the section chief, worked for 35 years. The 2007 was a hearing and review officer. So these are higher level employees, and they looked at the statute. So I disagree, Justice Alvin, with the premise of your question.
Well, the premise of my question is based upon the position taken from the Attorney General. That's what I was asking you.
And again, I'll incorporate by reference what I said earlier about the decision of the Attorney General.
Could a reasonably prudent employer have relied on these three decisions?
I believe they could, but Chief Justice Ravner, I would suggest that's not an issue on the record in this case. And the summary judgment motion is required by the rules. We had to submit a statement of uncontroverted facts to which the plaintiff had to admit or deny. And as to two of the three, the 2007 and the 2017, the plaintiff admitted that we relied upon those two decisions, and they can be found, what I'm referring to, in the appellate division appendix at pages 108 to 110.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Cott?
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to be very respectful of the court's time. I want to just make a couple of points quickly. Here, the legislature was, I think we can all agree, the legislature was trying to create a good faith defense. They might not necessarily have been making it easy for an employer to rely on the good faith defense, but they were not trying to make it impossible. The Attorney General's position here is contrary to the plain text of the law, and it simply can't be right that an employer needs to wait for a final agency decision, because that takes the concept of good faith entirely out of the statute. Because we're dealing here with the Cremoland case, Mr. Cott understandably did not reference the Fresh Funeral Home case, which is the only precedent before this one that addressed this statute. I'd like to talk about that case for a moment, because I'm here on behalf of small businesses throughout New Jersey that are going to have to try to figure out how to comply with this good faith statute. Justice Alvin, I think it has to be wrong, with all respect, that an employer has to go and get an advisory opinion or try to get an advisory opinion in order to be able to rely on the defense. In the Fresh Funeral Home case, the funeral home director said, look, number one, there are any number of regulations that define funeral homes as professionals subject to professional standards. Therefore, I believed I was acting as a professional. Second, I consulted with colleagues in the industry, and they were all interpreting the rules the same way I was, and I found no evidence that I was supposed to be doing anything different. And the court in that case held that the employer was able to act in good faith and acted in good faith. The Third Circuit in the Keeley case seemed to disapprove of the Fresh Funeral Home case, but I think that the Third Circuit in Keeley was being a little unfair to the court in Fresh, because what the court in Keeley said is, well, the judge did not parse the statute and figure out exactly which of the laundry list in the statute the funeral home followed. But I think that's not correct, because he said he relied on a regulation that defined the funeral home profession as defined funeral homes as professionals subject to professional standards. The last point I'd like to make is with regard to the Attorney General's position and the fact that the approvals or the interpretations in this case came from subordinate employees and not from the commissioner or the director. In just a moment, DAG Jones is going to do a spectacular job representing the Attorney General, as she always does. She is one of hundreds of employees in the building that have the ability to sign the Attorney General's name to a brief or an opinion, and we take it as a given that anyone who signs a brief out of that office on behalf of the Attorney General is acting on behalf of the Attorney General and stating the Attorney General's position. I think it is absolutely fair to say that the employees, the section chief, the other employees who are acting for the commissioner or the director, there's no indication they were acting ultra vires. There is no indication they were doing anything other than communicating an interpretation by. And Justice LaVecchia, I want to focus on that word by. It doesn't say interpretation from, it says interpretation by. I don't think there is any debate here that these employees were communicating an approval or interpretation by the director whose policy they were empowered to espouse.
But so, Mr. Jacobson, the language also doesn't omit the commissioner. It doesn't say by the Department of Labor and Industry. It says by the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and then more specifically, or a particular director of a particular bureau that was mentioned in the first clause. That's pretty specific in that first portion of the statute, is it not?
It is, Justice Levecchia, and I think it's specific because those are the two individuals who have the ability to set the direction for the office. It has to come from them. They have to be the ones. Similarly here, it is the Attorney General who is setting the tone for that office. The Deputy Attorneys General and Assistant Attorney Generals then carry forward. So I think that if I'm the legislator who's drafting this statute, I'm trying to figure out how am I going to create a good faith exception that businesses throughout New Jersey can rely on, I have to say, okay, the policy has to come by the commissioner or the director, but there had to have been a recognition that that policy was going to be communicated by subordinate employees. So again, it's easy to envision circumstances in which a communication would be so informal, so outside the expectations.
Mr. Jacobson, with your background in state government, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Cott. The other article has the additional language when it defines commissioner, it says commissioner or his designee. This article does not. It has a more specific definition of just the commissioner. Now, I grant you this statute was written in 1967, well before the existence of OAL or the development of much of administrative law that we are grappling with here. But nonetheless, we do have that differentiation between the two articles within Title 34.
You know, as an amicus, Your Honor, I think that's something you're going to have to wrestle with. I recognize that that is a problem in interpreting the statute, and I think that Mr. Cott said it very well, which is that we have to find a way to interpret those words in the real world in which we're living. And so in my background in state government, in Your Honor's background in state government, we know that we don't expect that everyone who receives a communication from every deputy attorney general is going to say, thank you very much, but can you please have that confirmed from the director so that I'm able to rely on it in this statute? It's something that we have to deal with the fact that the words say what they say, but they have to be interpreted in the real world that we're facing. And the last point I would make in response to the question, Justice Levecchia, is although it's important to look at these two parts of the statute separately, the things that have to come from the commissioner or the director on the one hand, or the policy of the department on the other, I don't know that the intent of the framers of the statute was to separate them that rigidly. I think they were looking at these two things working in harmony, and I think it's easy, number one, to look at what happened here in Cremoland as overall espousing a policy that was coming from the commissioner or the director through these communications, and I think that's the way that we can make the Fresh Funeral Home case make sense as well, that there's a policy that's coming forward about the way funeral homes were treated, that when a funeral home director in good faith asks his colleagues, what am I supposed to do here, he comes up with the answer without having to hire a lawyer to go get an advisory opinion, because that's something we can't expect small businesses throughout New Jersey to do.
May I ask you another question about the advisory opinion, Mr. Jacobson. Mr. Cott and you have made the point that if you went all the way to a commissioner's final agency decision, you would not need the good faith defense. You won. So the if you win below, if you win with the hearing officer, the section chief, the only way to get the commissioner's imprimatur on that, if that is the requirement, is to get an advisory opinion. How does that work, and can the commissioner simply ignore a request? I don't mean in any impolite way, but does the commissioner or the director have to provide an advisory opinion if requested to do so? How does that work as a practical matter?
Justice Patterson, I think that's exactly right, and it's the point I was trying to make, perhaps not as well as I could have with Justice Levecchia. I think the issue is that there are any number of communications that are coming from subordinate employees, and if we are going to read commissioner and director literally, then the message that will come forward from this court's opinion is, from now on, when you get a decision, I mean, one of two things has to happen. Either number one, every department in the state has to adopt the convention of the Attorney General's office, that every communication has to be signed commissioner by, and then we're going to simply decide as a matter of convention that that means the commissioner said it, even though the commissioner didn't actually say it, it came from a subordinate. Or alternatively, we're going to have to say that anyone in Cremo Land's position in the future has to respond to the subordinate employee, thanks very much, now please have that, you know, please have that confirmed by the director or the commissioner. And if it doesn't come, then you're stuck.
Mr. Jacobson,
and so, but is
Jacobson,
there a,
could,
do you have a right to an advisory opinion?
Not to my
knowledge. Can an entity, a person or entity, go to the commissioner and say, I need an advisory opinion from you as to whether or not these employees are in this category?
I never thought I was under an obligation to respond to every request. I don't think there is any such obligation
but,
in any department in the state.
Mr. Jacobson, can I ask you a more practical question? Assuming you could go to the commissioner, I'm sure you've heard that old saying, snatch victory from jaws of defeat. Would you, if the commissioner maybe changed his mind and now you lost by bringing it up, would you be snatching defeat from the jaws of victory and perhaps put your malpractice carrier on notice?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Your Honor. I think in Cremo Land's case, until a decision from this court to the contrary, I think Cremo Land had believed that it didn't need to do that. If this court says that that's what needs to happen, then I'd have to consult my malpractice carrier if I didn't, you know, stand on the commissioner's doorstep and bother him weekly until he confirmed the opinion, if, assuming Justice Patterson, I could make him do it. So
how about
I
if he
think
reversed,
that,
what then? How about if he reversed
well,
then, it by...
I think, Your Honor, that if the court were to decide that that's the interpretation of the statute, it needs to come from the commissioner, then someone in Cremo Land's position would have to do it and run the risk of a reversal. But I don't think, the commissioners and directors throughout the state empower subordinate employees to make this decision. This was not a close case in Cremo Land's situation because this was a consistent message that they were a trucking industry employer. But again, taking it to a higher level, I feel as though when you've got businesses throughout the state needing to rely on a good faith determination, it's not going to be as clear as it was in Cremo Land's case. They're going to have to rely on less than was here.